started with the new notebook, which is notebook 4, which says empty. Okay. And you'll fill it. So, Eric, the message was that those of you who are taking this for credit that should approach me to organize a problem, to discuss a problem that you will have to solve. Is any of you in this situation? Two of you? So we are missing two more people?
Yes.
Very good. All right, so let me start by going through what we did on Wednesday. Remember that I told you a story about CFTs and that the low energy spectrum of a CFT on the circle was organized in energies versus momenta or scaling dimensions versus conformal spin in a very clear way. There are some patterns. These are exact results. And what I wanted you to do was to match numerical results from the spin chain. You analyze the spin chain on the circle, the criticalizing model, rescale energies and momenta such that they look much like this. Okay, so that's what you were supposed to do. And then time was up. So let me quickly go. Does anybody have any question about that? Did anybody finish this? Betty? Oh, that's been recorded. You? Very good. Anyone else? All right, all my invisible friends said yes. That's good. So let's have a look at how you can do this. So exercise that we didn't have time to go through, obtain and plot numerical estimates of the 12 lowest scaling dimensions and conformal spins for the criticalizing model for 10 spins. And then there was a hint how to do that, which I rewrote here. So the idea was that on the lattice, if you diagonalize the Ising model, you'll get energies that look like this. They have some expression where there's some constant. There's a constant, another constant. We don't know A and B. These are non-universal. They are not given by the CFT. These are lattice. They depend on lattice details. But then the rest, this part of the expression is universal. And we have the scaling dimensions here. This is the number of spins in the spin chain. And there are corrections, which again are non-universal, but that they are suppressed by a higher power of n. Maybe it's 1 over n squared or something like that. So the idea is that we'll have to live with those guys, but if n is large enough, these contributions will be smaller than this one, and we will be able to extract the scaling dimensions. For that, I give you an extra hint. The extra hint was that, well, maybe I should say also that on the lattice, the momenta is 2 pi over n conformal spins. So this one is going to be easy. So the idea is that on any CFT, we have the identity state, which corresponds to the ground state. And so the lowest energy state, we know that has a scaling dimension and conformal spin 0 and 0. And in any CFT, we'll have the stress tensor state, we call it T, and has a scaling dimension and conformal spin 2,2. And with this information, if we manage to identify these two states on the low energy spectrum of the spin chain, we can use this information to get rid of A and B. Okay? Remember A is just shifting all the energies, and B is scaling them. If we know two points, that the lowest energy has to be 0 and certain energy has to be 2, this shift, this gives us the shift and then the risk, the scale. Okay? So there is enough information. If we identify these two low energy states, we have enough information to extract the scaling dimension. More explicitly, if you have the energy for any low energy state minus the energy for the ground state divided by the difference between energies for the stress tensor state and the identity state, you just replace in here this expression. You see that in subtracting two energies, A disappears, okay? Because this A is the same for all energies. And in taking the ratio, this factor disappears. So we're left with with this expression here, and then we know the scaling dimensions for the identity and for the stress tensor, so we know these three guys, and we're left with the scaling dimension that we want. So the idea is that if you identify the ground state and the stress tensor state, then you can, from the energies, we can extract the scaling dimensions, and then we can go and plot them here. That was the exercise. Yes?
Are the scaling dimensions in the CFT and in the discrete SE?
The scaling dimensions, properly speaking, are only defined for the CFT. And this expression tells you how to extract them from the spin chain. Scaling dimensions are a property of a CFT, of a conformal field theory.
Because we're using like the spin dimensions and the identity is so that's from the CFT, but you're using it in the
discrete. Right. So scaling dimensions are a property of a CFT. There is a very interesting immersion phenomenon happening when you look at the critical spin chain. What's very remarkable is that the low energy states of the spin chain are organized in the same way as the low energy states of the CFT. So there is this connection between energies. Remember that in the CFT, the energies of the low energy states would be directly 2 pi over n. This would be directly on the CFT alone. Okay? And so what's remarkable is that this is exactly this. This thing is E alpha CFT. Okay? So that's a highly non-trivial fact, that when you look at the low energy states of a critical spin chain, up to these constants and higher order corrections, the energies are the same that you would have in the CFT. So we're exploiting that to learn about the immersion CFT from the spin chain. Good. All right, so then what do we need to do? This was the homework or the exercise. And we won't have a lot of time today. I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time with this. I just want to point out that half of what you had to do was already from previous classes, just copy-paste tech. Functions. So we want to build the translation operator. We know how to build a Hamiltonian. Right? We had a function that builds the Hamiltonian. So we have another function that builds the translation operator. We can build a parity operator, but these are functions that we built in previous classes. Or maybe I should. Yeah. And then here's a piece of code that looks very similar to things you've done in the past. So we set the number of spins to 10. Okay. This is the number of low energy states that we're going to keep, or we're going to look at. You can see that we're going to be using x, the sparse eigenvalue solver, and we'll ask to only identify n states. N states, so 12 lowest energy states. Good. So we just build the Hamiltonian, the translation operator, the parity operator. And remember what we did. We want to simultaneously diagonalize these three matrices to break the degeneracy. And so we build some matrix, which is just a combination of H, T, and P, a Hamiltonian, the translation operator, and the parity operator.
A question on that. These constants, to minus 2 and so on, they are just arbitrary.
I made them up.
With other numbers as well, if you just choose a random number, it shouldn't be 1, obviously.
Right. If you choose a random number, it should be fine. We're trying to break the degeneracy.
Okay.
So if you choose the number to be 1 or 2, maybe you shift the degeneracies and you end up with the same problem. But otherwise, you should be fine.
Can you explain the last term?
This one.
Yeah,
this one is very important. Oh, should explain it, huh? So the first thing is that this I here is the identity operator, and it's something that Julia 1.0 gives you, that I don't think used to be there. So let's have a look at it. It's called uniform scaling, whatever. So if I have a matrix, so we've been building identities by diagonal matrix of ones and so on. But in Julia, you can have this I, which automatically is the identity. And you don't even need to specify the dimensions. It reads the dimensions from the matrix in front. So in this case, I is a 2x2 matrix identity. Okay. If M had been 3x3 matrix, I would be 3x3. OK, so let's have a look then at this term. So here what we have is the matrix that we want to diagonalize. And then I subtract the identity by a quantity that is proportional to the system size n. And what the goal of this term is to make sure that in absolute value, the low energy states have the largest energy. So we don't know how much the energies are. This could be the energies. We could have this guy, this guy. Okay, this could be our spectrum. If we want to capture the lowest energy states, what we want to do first is to change where the origin is. We want to rescale, to shift all the energies such that the ones that we want have the largest absolute value. Okay, that's because in here we haven't specified the third input that we could have specified. Aix could come with, I think we saw that last time. You give me the matrix that you want to diagonalize, then you want to specify how many eigenvalues you want, maybe two eigenvalues, eigenvectors. And finally, you could say which, and maybe smallest real part. We've done this, right? There are several options that you can specify here. Now, our matrix, the Hamiltonian, had real eigenvalues, so we could have done that. But once we start mixing it with other operators, the spectrum has changed. It's complex now. Okay, and so we cannot specify smallest real part. That's not going to work for us anymore. So instead, what we do is we just shift all the spectrum such that the low energy states correspond to the largest absolute value, to the eigenvalues with largest absolute value. Okay, so that's a trick that we can play, and we'll be playing also next week. We shift the energy such that the states that we want have the lowest energies, but also the largest absolute values. Okay. Yes.
So how do you know how to
shift? Right. So. What I do is I know that the Hamiltonian is made. That's a very good question. Maybe I should have explained this better. So we know that the Hamiltonian is made of n pieces because we have a local term that we sum n times. And I know that 2 is big enough because I had to look at the two-side Hamiltonian, and I saw that the largest eigenvalue was smaller than 2. So if I shift that, it would be good enough. As a matter of fact, just believe me here, and I think on Wednesday we'll have a look at that more explicitly. Okay? But yeah, this is large enough that to accomplish what I said, that the low energy state is also the a state with the energy is the largest in absolute value. All right, very good. Questions are good. So, and then once we've de-analyzed, remember we obtain that the matrix U, so D, oh, you want this bigger, right? You never tell me. Okay. So once we have D contains the energies or the eigenvalues of this, not the energies, but the eigenvalues of this matrix, and U the eigenvectors. And now what we want to do is to read a vector of energies, momenta, and also parity, but this is something we did already. Okay, I'm just copying code from a previous class. And then we sort permute the energies so that they go from smallest to largest. And we reorganize not just the energies, but the corresponding momentum parity. And then we can have a look at these three columns to make sure that it worked as expected. And you have it here. These are energies, the 12 lowest energies from the smallest to the largest. And these are the corresponding momenta. And these are the parities. And we keep processing in a way that we had done before, except that, OK, so sorry, what's new is the following now. We translate from momenta, we produce spins. Okay, I'm just using this expression here. So the spins would be momenta times n divided by 2 pi. Times n divided by 2 pi. And then what I need to do now is to look for who is the stress tensor. I need to find this guy. Okay. But what did I tell you about this guy? It's the state with momentum with spin 2 and lowest energy. So from all the spectra that we have here, I need to look at conformal spin 2, okay, and look at what's the state with lowest energy. I just computed the spins, right? So now I need to look at states with spin 2 and look which one is the one with smallest energy, which will correspond to smallest scaling dimension. And so this is what is being done here. We start I is an index that labels all the states. I was using alpha there, here I'm using I. And I say let's run over all low energy states. And for each of them, if the spin, conformal spin is 2, okay, then and we haven't found the stress tensor yet, and that's gonna be the stress tensor. Okay. And after doing that, so after this loop, I stress instead of being 1, now is some number that corresponds to, in the list of low energy states, the stress tensor. And then we're done. We just take the scaling dimensions and we rescale them. So the scaling dimensions correspond to this expression, but this is nothing but this expression here. I'm just shifting and rescaling the energies. And then I display the result again. And so before we had energies, momenta, and parity, now we have scaling dimensions, conformal spins, and parity. Parity didn't change. And we have that this one was used to, this will be zero for sure, because we shifted everything so that this one will be zero. And this is going to be two for sure, because we rescale everybody so that this could be two. But the rest are predictions, numerical predictions. Okay. And finally, we just go back. This part here is just going to plot all these scaling dimensions and conformal spins. Okay. And again, we see the blue dots are the numerical results. No wonder that we get a hit exactly here, because we've shifted the energy so that this is zero. Again, this guy also is the stress tensor. We force that to be spot on. But the rest are approximations. And you see that, for instance, the energy density here is a bit shifted. And these guys are a bit shifted, and so on. Okay, so if we wanted, we didn't use anything here to obtain the results. We didn't use previous knowledge that this was the Ising model, in the sense that the identity and stress tensor always exist in any CFT. So if you give me now a different Hamiltonian corresponding to another quantum critical point, I can use exactly the same steps. And what I'll get is a different distribution of scaling dimensions and conformal spins. Okay? And from there, I'll be able to read important information. For instance, this guy determines certain power law decay of correlations and is related to critical exponents and so on. All right, so that was a short summary of what we did on Wednesday. Are there questions here? If not, I would like to move to the next topic. It's quantum entanglement. And let's see. This should be fun. I always say that. And this will be notebook 4. We'll start with maybe 10 minutes of theory, and then we'll go to the notebook. So let me see. Quantum entanglement. We're back to quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, we have a bipartite system. So a system made of two parts, A and B. Then what we have is the vector space describing, or the Hilbert space describing A and B, is the same as the tensor product of the Hilbert space for part A times the Hilbert space for part B. What does this mean? It means that if we have a basis I for part A and a basis J for part B, right? So this would be I equal to 1, 2, 3. This one could be J equal to 1, 2, whatever. Then we have a basis for the whole vector space, which is just the product of those. So the basis I, J for AB, or let's just say FJ, which is equal to I on A, tensor J on B. Okay, so we have this basis on AB. So example, to make it very, very concrete. I'm going to assume that the dimension of A is 3. The dimension of B is 2. And so I'm going to write any state of the composite system as a linear combination with some coefficients like this. So the basis is made of runs over ij for I going from 1 to 3, and j goes from 1 to 2. Okay? So this would be a vector space where you have, on part A, you have 3 levels. On part B, you have 2 levels. These are 1, 2, 3. These are 1 and 2. These are my bases. And so I have that the total Hilbert space is spanned by, it's 6 dimensional, right? Dimension of AB is dimension of A times dimension of B equal to 6. Okay? Those of you who usually work with quantum mechanics, that's trivial. Those of you who are not used to that, maybe it's good to remember. Okay? Are you familiar with this? Tensor product of two Hilbert spaces. So now, if you're okay with this, now we want to start talking about properties of states in this tensor product. So I'm going to define what the product state is. That's a definition. Product state of the composite system is some state that can be written as a state for part A times state for part B. Okay? Example. State 1, 1. Right? Because it's 1 times 1. Okay? That's a product state. Another example, we could consider this one here doesn't look that it's just product of part A and B, because it looks like this, but we can reorganize it as can reorganize it in this form. Now it's clear that in part A it's always 1, and in part B it's 1 plus 2. Okay? So that's a state for A and that's a state for B. So it's a product state. All right. Is that clear? Because then, if that's clear, I want to define what's an entangled state. An entangled state is nothing but the state of this composite system that cannot be written as a product state. That's what we call entangled state. We say this state has entanglement. And so an example would be a state that looks like this. Okay. Being a combination of 1, 1 plus 2, 2. Doesn't matter how you try, you won't be able to write it as state for A times state for B. OK, so maybe at this point, make a test, see whether you are listening. So this state, would this state be a product state or an entangled state? Product state? Why? Because by definition, right, what that means is this. Yes? OK. How about this one? Product?
Yeah.
Why? What you mean? Okay, very good. All right. So, so what we need to do now before we continue is we go to the notebook and have a look at how we're going to encode these things. So, yeah.
So we just get rid of any item of this four term, it goes to a state, right?
Yeah. Yes. Then it cannot be factorized anymore. All right, so please start the notebook 4, quantum entanglement. We start by using pyplot, linear algebra, and RPAC. If you were here on Wednesday, you should already have this added, these packages added. And so remember how we're going to take a wave function on a space, on a six-dimensional vector space. That could be our favorite this system, okay? Six-dimensional. So we can create wave function with random coefficients, random complex coefficients by using RAN. Remember that we can compute also the scalar product, and in particular, I noticed that with respect to previous versions of Julia, that this is already, this is a vector times, so a column vector times a row vector, and the result is already a number. It's not an array, a one times one array anymore. I used to have to extract the number from inside the array. In Julia 1, this is no longer the case. That's already a number. Nice. I think in a previous lecture I told you otherwise. All right, so what we can do is, because we can compute, this would be the square of the norm. So we can take the square root of this number and divide psi by that in a way that we normalize the state. Okay? So we've created a random state. We look at its norm. We decide to divide the state by the square root of the norm. When we compute again, the scalar product with itself, we get a 1. That's how we normalize the state. What else? And then that's going to be news here. We're going to take the vector. This vector is understood as a matrix, is a 6 times 1 matrix. And we're going to reshape it so that it becomes matrix, which is 3 times 2. Okay? So we're going to be using reshape a lot here. Reshape allows you to reorganize the indices. So the idea is that if you look at here, we have 6 complex coefficients, but it's natural to organize them as a matrix of indices ij. Right? I runs from 1 to 3, j runs from 1 to 2. But we want to, instead of writing this as a vector with 6 coefficients, we prefer to write it, it's going to be useful to write it as a 3 times 2 matrix. And the way to convert 6 coefficients, a vector of 6 coefficients, into a matrix that is 3 times 2 is by using reshape. So in reshape, you put here whatever object you have. We call it psi in there. This, remember, this has structure 6,1 or the 6 as a matrix. And then we specify that we want to turn it into a 3,2. Okay? And there are some rules that organize how this is done, what elements go where. So if I'm right, the way it works is that if these are the 6 elements of psi, then we'll take this into here and this into here. That's going to be our 3 times 2 matrix. Okay? Good. So then we can reshape it. Let's see if that's what we want. Maybe what I can do, though, that's fine.
A question?
Yes.
Why did you start with a normal distribution and not a uniform distribution? Does it make a difference?
Not in this example, but in something that we'll look at later, it will. Because the normal distribution will produce states are compatible with, so that they are completely random in the Hilbert space, whereas the flat distribution would not, there will be some, it does not produce completely random states in the Hilbert space. It has some bias. All right, so now it's time to talk about reduced density matrices. So what I want to do is, instead of asking you every time, is this state entangled or not, and then you have to think cleverly whether you can split it into two pieces, right? Turns out that we can define a measure of entanglement, and if this measure is zero, then we know it factorizes, it's a product state, and if it's non-zero, we know it doesn't factorize. Okay, so we don't have to start thinking all the time. And this measure comes from looking at the reduced density matrix. For part A, so remember that in quantum mechanics, the reduced density matrix for part A, it's defined, it's called the partial trace over B. And we can always, well, and what it means is we sum over all possible states in B. Okay, so we have, we take our density, our state, we produce a projector, and then we multiply by a basis in B, and we add overall components. And this produces an object, this density matrix, which lives, which is an operator on part A only. And as such, we can expand it. So it's just some matrix, and these are the coefficients of the matrix. And these coefficients are given in very simple terms. They are easy to compute. So you just need to take the components, remember that psi AB, or sum over I and j of psi ij, I and j. So the we take the components of the vector, which we express as a matrix. We take a copy and second copy, complex conjugate the second copy, and we have a sum over j's. Okay? But this is nothing but taking this guy. Think of this as a matrix with coefficients ij. And what we're doing is we're taking the matrix and we're multiplying it by its adjoint. Okay, so there is a very simple compact form that says you want to compute the reduced density matrix. What I want to say is this. This is the expression in components, but what it boils down to is that the reduced density matrix is the result of taking the wave function expressed as a matrix times its adjoint. Okay? We multiply these two. Let's think whether this makes sense. So remember, this is a 3 times 2 matrix. The adjoint is a 2 times 3 matrix. If you multiply these guys together, how do you do that? You do it, and then you realize that indeed you have a 3 times 3 matrix. Okay? So that's how you can quickly compute the reduced density matrix for part A. You organize your wave function, the coefficients in your wave function, as a matrix, and multiply it by its adjoint. That gives you the reduced density matrix. Okay. And remember that physically, this reduced density matrix contains all the information about anything you want to know about subsystem A. Okay? So in order to ask questions about observables, expectation values on AB, you need psi. But if all your observables that you care about are on part A, row A, the reduced density matrix row A, contains all the information that you want. That's quantum mechanics. Very good. So we can compute the reduced density matrix, okay? And once we have the reduced density matrix, we can introduce the entanglement entropy. Of the original bipartite state, this is going to be the von Neumann entropy, some entropy of rho A, defined to be minus the trace of rho A log 2 rho A. And when I say log 2, this is the convention that we use in quantum information. Some people use log, natural log, but this is just our convention. So. And let's not get carried away with which convention is best. This one is best. And what that, you know, this is the trace of matrix times the logarithm of that matrix. This matrix by construction is Hermitian, it can be diagonalized. And so if you look in terms of the eigenvalues, then it's minus sum eigenvalues log of the m eigenvalues. Okay, and this is the final expression. So it's a normal entropy for the eigenvalues of the density matrix. Okay, so and this is the end of the theory for today. So let me summarize what I introduced. We have a Hilbert space made of two pieces, A and B. We can consider wave functions. Those wave functions can be written in a natural way as a matrix of coefficients. Okay. And then we consider the reduced density matrix, rho A, which is defined by taking the partial trace over B. And in practice, this matrix can be built as the product of the matrix psi times its adjoint. And from rho A, we can compute this entanglement entropy by diagonalizing rho A, extracting the eigenvalues, and then taking the entropy of the eigenvalues. Now, going back to why I introduced this, remember I said, instead of trying to figure out whether a state is a product state or an entangled state, what we can do, we can compute the reduced density matrix. And it turns out, it's easy to show, that this entropy, which is always positive defined, will only be zero if the state was a product state. So this entropy will tell us whether the original bipartite state psi AB was entangled or not. But it will do more than that, right? If it's zero, we know the state is a product state. But if it's non-zero, it will give us a number. And this number, there is some concrete meaning to it, which has to do with how entangled or different from a product state your state is. You can, if the entropy is very small, maybe your state is very close to a product state. If the entropy is large, your state cannot be close to product state. Okay? So we can use the entanglement entropy as a measure of how much entanglement we have between A and B, how far from a product state between A and B we are. And this will be a very useful quantity to look at for today and next week. But more generally, in physics, it's a big deal, entanglement entropy. I think you have to be working on strong gravity not to find entanglement entropy everywhere. Anything that is quantum nowadays has a lot to do with entanglement entropy. So now let's look at how we compute this quantity in practice. And for that, we have already written our wave function, psi AB, as a matrix, right? So the first thing we need to do is to compute the reduced density matrix. And this is what is being done here. after reshaping, the reduced density matrix for part A is just the product of this matrix times its adjoint. Okay? For completeness, if you wanted the density matrix for B, it's the same expression except that the prime is on the other side, the dagger is on the other side. But we won't use the reduced density matrix for B today. And then what we can do is, just to be sure that we are doing things properly, we can look at the sizes or what type of matrices we get. So the reduced density matrix for A, sorry, first we look at the original wave function. It's a matrix 3 times 2. Then the reduced density matrix for A has dimensions 3 times 3, as we expected. And if instead we had computed the reduced density matrix for B, it's a 2 times 2 matrix. So this makes sense. Right, so we can move on. You can check that the trace is 1. That follows directly from the fact that we had originally normalized the wave function. OK, and then let's do something with that. But now I don't remember if in your, I think that in your notebook you have this one, right?
Yes.
Good. So the idea here is that today, what we will do is we'll compute the ground state of a Hamilton, of the Ising model again, for a number of spins, and we'll study the entanglement entropy of how it scales with the size of the region that we're looking at. So A will be one spin, or two spins, or three spins, part A. And as a function of the size of A, we'll see how the entanglement grows. And to do that, to get started, we'll just go. I gave you two functions that will be useful, and you'll have to build the rest. So let me describe these two functions. This function is very simple. Given a metric representation of the bipartite wave function psi AB, this function just checks that this is indeed a matrix. So it has two indices. Then it checks that it's not the we're going to build a matrix. And it checks that it checks that it's not going to be too big, just in case. So when you go from psi AV to the reduced density matrix, it could be that the final object is much larger than the original one. So you just want to be careful that you don't saturate the memory in your computer, for instance. So that's a reasonable check. And finally, just computes the reduced density matrix, right? That's just the expression we've discussed before. That's just this here. OK? So this was so simple, I decided to be generous and write it for you. Now, just to set some notation for what comes later, we can test how this works. NA denotes the number of spins or qubits. So what we have in mind now is that, let me explain this a bit better. So we've discussed part A, part B, right? We have a system that's bipartite. It's made of part A, part B. But now we're going to consider a more general setting where we have n spins or n qubits. Spin 1/2 or n qubits, right? Two-dimensional sites on a lattice. And part A could be this, in which case we'll say that part A contains three spins, three qubits. And part B then is going to be the rest, in which case we're going to say MB is equal to 5. Okay? So we're going to be thinking that what we have is the state of a large spin chain. A large 10 spins, for instance. And we're going to look at entanglement properties between this part A and this part B. Okay? When we get tired of looking at this particular bipartition of the spin chain, we may change our mind. And maybe part A will be 4 spins, and part B will also be 4 spins. So what I'm trying to set here is the notation for that. NA is the number of spins in part A, and B is the number spins in part B. Now we will produce a wave function, a random wave function, on NA time plus NB spin, so on 9 spins. The dimension is 2^9. Make it complex. We normalize the wave function. We then reshape it into a matrix form. Okay? And we just test that this thing is doing that we test the compute reduced density matrix for part A function, which for input we put the bipartite wave function and should produce as an output the reduced density matrix. So let's test this. Didn't work. That's probably because I forgot. I was talking too much, right? Oh, but this is not the one I want to follow. Okay. Okay, so the result is an array with 16 numbers. Why 16 numbers? And can somebody tell me why we have 16 numbers as the answer of the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix for part A? It is not a 4x4 matrix.
The number of spins in the case.
That's correct. That's right, which is 16. So it's a 16 times 16 matrix. So it makes sense that the answer was 16 eigenvalues. Yes? Good. All right, so I think I'm giving you one more hint, and then it's time for you to work. Right, so let's see how we would compute, given a reduced density matrix, how we would compute this entanglement entropy. Okay? So the input will be a matrix, which is the density matrix. And we can just get the eigenvalues. And then we set the entropy to 0. And we'll add contributions to the entropy eigenvalue by eigenvalue. Originally, I thought, let's write it like this. It's just vector times the log of the vector. There is a problem with that, because sometimes, and it will happen, definitely happens sometimes, so p might be very small, okay, and the log gets confused. So of course, if p is very small, but there is a p in front, so a particular eigenvalue being very small, the log may go crazy, but this guy should make it shut up, right? So in here, if we have, say, P1 log P1, if this was very small, let's call it epsilon, this guy becomes very large. But there is an epsilon in front, and the limit when epsilon goes to 0 of this is 0. But the computer doesn't know yet. It just computes log of 0, okay, and says not a number. So just to make sure that there are no problems like that, I decided to have a loop. Okay? And so it identifies a non-zero any eigenvalue of the density matrix that is larger than 10 to the minus 12. And it just adds contributions to the entropy for those eigenvalues. Okay, this one ran for a while, and then for a particular application, the function started not behaving, and it's precisely because there were eigenvalues that were 0. So that's the safe way of doing that. Then we return the result of the sum. Okay, and I think that's all the hints I wanted to give. So we can test that this works. At least it gives you a number. Let me see. Right, so this is your notebook. So now you are on your own. What I would like you to do is to end up being able to plot these entropies for a number of interesting states. So we'll produce, say, with 12 spins, we'll produce we would like to be able to do. Maybe I'll just show you the result and then it will be clear. Okay. So this is a plot of the number of sites or spins on part A versus the entropy on that block. Okay, so for each size of A, remember we have some number of spins. And now we say NA equal to 1, that means A is here and the rest is B. Then we can say NA equal to 2, and so on. Okay? So for each of these settings, you can compute the entropy of row A, right? And you'll have an entropy of row A that depends on how many spins you have in region A. And what we want to do then is to plot these entropies. Okay? So that would be the entropy for one spin, two spins, three spins, four spins, and so on. Okay? And this will be for another wave function. So that's the task for you. And the first part is number 3. It's just to have a function that, given the full wave function, will the full state on capital N spins will compute all these entropies from NA equal to 1 all the way to NA equal to N over 2. And let's focus on this one, and then we'll discuss the rest later. So the next step, in the next step, what you want to do is to generate interesting examples of states on n qubits, for n, let's say, 12. Okay? For n equal to, say, 12, but not much more than that, create ground state of the Ising model for two values of the angle theta, as well as a random state. Random state, just use this rand n, okay? So remember, n, if n, the number of spins is 12, this means 2 to the 12 components. And I think I gave you the Hamiltonian. Yeah. So you have the function that builds the Hamiltonian, so you just have to use aix to get the ground state after building the Hamiltonian. Okay. So this should be pretty simple, so let's do that for the next 5 minutes, and those who want to catch up. Actually, let me tell you everything, and then you can take your time. So and once you've built those two wave functions, we're going to, those three wave functions, we're going to plot the entropy as a function of the, for each of these three wave functions, the ground state of the Ising model for one theta, for another theta, and finally a random state, I want you to compute the array, a vector of entropies, sequence of entropies, and plot it as we discussed earlier. Okay, the plot would be NA as NA, the entropy of part A as a function of the size of A, right? And then we'll discuss what that means. So let's see. This is how a professional would do this, huh? No, actually.
Oh, he puts it into different log videos.
Okay, so what's this? Right. Yeah, so I take the function that creates the Hamiltonian, and then I just do the obvious thing. So for n equal to 12, I build a Hamiltonian for theta equal to pi over 4, critical Ising model. And I use x with number of eigenvalues or eigenvectors equal to 1. Just look for the one with the smallest real part in the eigenvalue. So that will be the lowest energy, the ground state. And we don't really care about the eigenvalue. We just care about this metric, which is a 2 to the n times 1 matrix. And so we can get the psi Ising critical ground state by just taking this matrix and looking at the first column. Right, that's the first column. It's the only column of this matrix. But anyway. So we can repeat the same, exactly the same story with angle pi over 3. Now it's not critical. And we call this psi Ising 2, or however you want to call it. And I wasn't sure how to free memory. This Hamiltonian is huge. It's a 4,000 times 4,000 matrix. It's not huge, but still feels silly to keep it. And so I tried to remove it. And maybe, Eric, you'll tell me how to do that, a better job, because I look at the statistics of my computer and the memory is still fully used.
That should refer.
OK. So maybe I made some copy somewhere. Very good. Anyway, the random state is piece of cake, right? It's rand 2 to the n plus imaginary times rand 2 to the n. And you just want to normalize it. I didn't normalize these guys because they come normalized from the x function. All right, and then we wanted to use the functions that we've been writing to plot this. So, well, we compute the entropies, of course, for each of these states. And then when I plot the entropy for the random state, I get this. Okay? So again, maybe I should work on the axis, but this is when the subsystem A is 1 spin, 2 spins, 3 spins, all the way to 6. Remember, it's 12 spins, so all the way to half is 6. And the entropy seems to grow linearly. Maybe not so much in here, but it's, you know, for 1 spin, entropy is 1. For 2 spins, the entropy is 2. For 3 spins, the entropy is 3. Okay, it's kind of saturated. All right, and then we could do the same. What's going on here? OK. And then we could do the same for the Ising model. And I've plotted the result in a single plot. This would be the scaling of the entanglement entropy as a function of the region A, or the part A, for 1 spin, 2 spins, and so on. For when we are not at criticality. And this is the case when we are at criticality. And you can see that the critical case is much more entangled, right? For the same size of the region, say 1 spin or 2 spins, the amount of entanglement entropy between those two, the entanglement entropy of the state when we break the spin chain into 2 spins and 10 spins is much more for the critical ground state than for the off-critical ground state. So this is something interesting, because it tells us that at criticality, when we reach a quantum critical point, the ground state is more entangled.
Okay.
The ground state of a critical system is more entangled than a ground state of criticality. But the really spectacular surprise comes when we compare, when we plot the three guys together, as I did here. So this is the Ising model of criticality. This is the Ising model at criticality. And clearly, this is more entangled than this. But look at the random state. Okay? The random state is way more entangled. The red line is the maximum entanglement or entropy that you could have, the absolute maximum. Okay? And the random state almost saturates that. Whereas the critical ground state and off-critical ground state, they are far, far from that. So this was an observation that was made now several years ago, many years ago, but has led to the observation that maybe this property, the fact that ground states are not very entangled, maybe this property can be exploited to find a variational class of wave functions, okay, that allow us to go to efficiently study systems of spins that have many, many more spins, not just 10 or 20. So next week, on Monday, Wednesday, we'll see how, without exploiting anything yet, we can double the system size. We'll be diagonalizing. We'll be considering ground states of, say, 20 spins in a few seconds. Okay, we'll compute ground states of 20 spins in a few seconds. But we'll still be bounded by this exponential growth of computational resources. So we can do 20, and then you try 24, 26, and you slow down. Okay, with a big computer, we can go to 30, maybe nowadays 40 spins, but that's it. And then on Friday next week, we'll see that we can exploit this property here, the fact that ground states are, compared to random states, ground states are much less entangled, to actually change our algorithm completely, our perspective completely, and find a strategy to simulate, to compute ground states on spin change of, say, 100 spins, 1,000 spins, even infinitely many spins. Okay? So that I will describe on Friday. We won't write the code for that, but I'll tell you how this works. Okay? Very good. So for the rest of today, you know, 20 minutes, I think there is 20 minutes, there is some event that we are all invited and encouraged to go to.